This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. On June 25th, 2018, hardly anybody had heard of a young activist recently working as a waitress named Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. A day later, she pulled off a surprise win in a congressional primary for New York's 14th district, and she was on her way to Washington. Her election as a young woman of color was a huge story, and it's been one big story after another for Ocasio-Cortez. She's battled Nancy Pelosi on many things, including the Green New Deal. She called for the abolition of ICE and recently referred to migrant detention facilities as concentration camps. She became the hero of the left wing and a favored villain of Fox News and the right, practically from the day she started. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joined me about a week ago, just after her tour with other lawmakers of migrant detention facilities on the border. I think it's about a year ago that this all began. This big victory for you happened. What shocked you the most?
In this whole year?
Well, and holding this office and the political life once you're in office.
I think when I first got into office after getting sworn in, I struggled with a large deal of imposter syndrome. Do I belong here? They're going to find out. As soon as they find out, they're going to
take it back?
Exactly. It's going to get taken back. And so I struggled with that a lot. But after acclimating to the actual functions of this job and this role, I think one of the things that has been shocking to me is how normal it is, like the...
Normal in what sense?
In how enormous decisions are made in ways that feel like a typical office sometimes, you know?
For example.
So there will be miscommunications or there'll be debates or there's that guy you don't like on the second floor or, you know, things like that. And they all have real dynamics and real consequences in decision making. And, you know, for example, you know, last week with the border supplemental, which was this big controversy both within the party but also nationally. And
this is the conflict between the Senate Democrats and the House Democrats as well as with the Republicans as well.
Right, right. And so the ways that this very flawed and a supplemental, which I've personally voted against, along with many other members, the way that it came to the floor was like, what's going on? Who's saying what? And you're hearing secondhand about what might be happening, and it kind of unfolds within 30 minutes. And then before you know it, Congress has voted on $4.6 billion with no accountability.
So you're saying governing is a mess in a way?
Yeah, it's a mess. It's a mess.
What's your relationship like with Nancy Pelosi? Tell me how that works. What are the dynamics of it?
I think sometimes people think that we have this, like, we have a relationship.
Are you saying you don't?
Not particularly. Not one that's, I think, distinguished from anyone else. Like, if there's a legislative need. You know, the last time I kind of spoke to her one-on-one was when she asked me to join the Select Committee on Climate Change.
What did she say?
I said no.
Why?
Because I had made very specific requests, which I thought were rather reasonable, for the Select Committee on Climate Change. I asked that it have a mission to try to draft legislation by 2020 so that we essentially have a 2-year mission to put together, whether it's a Green New Deal or whether it's some sweeping climate change legislation, that the Select Committee have a legislative mission. I asked for it to have subpoena power, which most committees do. The last Select Committee had subpoena power, but now this one doesn't. And I asked for the members who sit on the Select Committee to not take any fossil fuel money. And none of those requests were accommodated, and so I didn't join the committee.
Are you better on the outside looking in or the inside looking out?
I think I'm better on the outside looking in on this issue.
Why is that?
Because given that none of those standards were met, sitting on that committee, I would have to own anything. I would take responsibility for anything that comes out of that committee. That it's beyond just a mere disagreement. I think there's a structural problem with it. And so I think that ultimately I'm fine with the decision, especially given the committee assignments that I was ultimately given, which were very intense and very rigorous. I was assigned to two of some of the busiest committees and 4 subcommittees. So my hands are full. And sometimes I wonder if they're trying to keep me busy.
Well, I think there's one thing that everybody would agree on, including your most ardent opponents, is that in this year, your voice has cut through. It's cut through to supporters. It has certainly cut through to the Murdoch press. You are big business for Fox News and for the New York Post and all the rest. How did it cut through? Why did it cut through? And was that the plan?
It takes a lot to unseat an incumbent, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. And so in order to make that argument over a year, while I had no money to amplify my message, when I had very little resources, very little outside attention, I needed to, over the course of a year, year and a half, really hone in a very strong voice. And so I think that after the primary, when a lot of people started to kind of say, what's going on here, I continued in that same voice that still cut through to my constituents and to my district. I think there's a couple of things. One is that there is kind of like an apologetic nature, I think, to a lot of Democratic messaging. It's like, this is wrong, but not all people, but not all this.
And particularly freshmen and particularly women even? Do you think that's the case?
Well,
because it seems
like
the strongest
general.
It seems like the strongest voices by leaps in this freshman class are women and women of color.
Yeah. Well, I think overall with the party that has been the norm, but when it comes to women of color in Congress, particularly the freshmen, it's that we both have encountered and represent communities that have been auctioned off and negotiated off for the last 20 years, and we're over it. You know, if we're going to have a change election, it needs to...
What do you mean by auctioned off?
Well, we see in these negotiations all the time, it's like fighting for Black communities or policies that help women. They're bargaining chips, and they're the first chips that are reached for in any legislative negotiation.
Now, you have just come back from the border, and this was an experience that I think was disturbing on a number of levels. I just, maybe talk me through that trip. What did you see? Just in human terms, what did you see?
I mean, it was horrible. We went into this facility, which is where we saw some of the most inhumane behavior, was the El Paso Customs and Border Patrol.
What are you seeing?
Detention
there?
Facility. So we walk in, and that morning the ProPublica piece had been released.
This is about the Facebook group of people who were working there and all kinds of abusive comments directed at you and others.
Yeah, and there were 9,500 current and former CBP officers engaged in a secret, violently racist and sexist Facebook group, and where they mocked migrant deaths, where they actually discussed launching a GoFundMe for any officer that harmed myself or Veronica Escobar. And so we get there, we sit down in this boardroom, and all these CBP officers are standing up around us. And another member kind of confronted them and said, well, what about this group? Are any of you all in it? So it immediately did not start off well. Then we leave it. You know, it was this whole argument. And then another member said, you know, they're trying to filibuster us in this conference room so that we don't see what's going on. So we go out, we step out, and we get into this main control room. And it's basically, it's kind of a circular room. And the center of the room was this kind of little perch with screens and with surveillance feeds. And then the perch kind of had a little wider sub perch on the outside, and it was surrounded by glass. And that's where...
This is where detainees are living.
This is where detainees are being kept. I wouldn't even call it living because it was that inhumane. And then there were these cells all around.
Inhumane because it resembled a prison? Inhumane because of the crowding? What were the conditions that you saw?
It's not even living. So we walked in, and in one of the cells, the cell is just all concrete. So it's there were just women on a concrete floor, and then there were two concrete slabs where they could sit. And then in the back, there was a toilet and a concrete slab in front of the toilet, but no door. Mm. And these women were just in these sleeping bags on the floor over each other. There's no way that they could all sleep at once. Almost no way. And I mean, they were being, it was the physical manifestation of Trump's rhetoric in calling migrants animals, because that's how these women were being treated. Their hair was falling out. They had sores in their mouth due to the lack of nutrition in the food that they were being given.
What were they being fed?
They would wake up in the morning, and CBP would wake them up between 5 and 7 a.m. And they said pretty much for no reason. They were being woken up very early in the morning, but they wouldn't take them anywhere. They weren't allowed to go outside. They were just being woken up. In the morning, they'd be given kind of like a this one woman took out a Nature Valley oat and honey bar for breakfast. And then I saw two oranges on the floor. And they said that they would be given sometimes a sandwich or a burrito, but no greens, no fresh food. And the lack of those nutrients develops canker sores. If you're just eating mm-hmm. bread for days and
days.
How
long have they been there?
One woman had been there for 60 days.
And these are people who had come from where?
The women in the first cell were from Cuba. They were all from Cuba, yeah. And so they're being detained there, and they separated these women. So
from their children?
Yes, yes.
Where are the kids?
I mean, this is when all the women started sobbing and breaking down. You know, I went in there, and I just started asking questions. And at first, they didn't know what was going on. And so then I was like, you know, hold up, rewind. This is who we are. We're members of Congress. We know that there are issues in this facility, and we need to find out what's going on. And that's when they just started bursting. They were almost falling over each other trying to tell me everything. You know, they took my kids over here. I have two children here. I'm trying to find out where they were. They took me here. They moved us there. And so so first I started asking them what their day was like to understand their conditions from their perspective. I asked them who had been separated from their children. In that room, two of the women had their children taken away. But meanwhile, it's important to contextualize this, that family separation is more than just taking parents away from their children. What people are saying and what the administration is saying and qualifies as an unaccompanied child and quote-unquote fake families or human trafficking, what they are talking about with respect to that are also children that come with their brothers and sisters, children that come with their grandparents, children that come with their aunts and uncles. And so there were two women that were separated from their direct children nonetheless. And so I asked them where they went. And I also asked what some of the other facilities were, because we saw all these empty tents. We went in here and in Clint. There were all of these tents that almost looked like dog kennels, and they were just empty. And I asked these women, how many people are here? And they're like, there's no one else here. There's no one else here. And I said, well, why is there no one else here? We've been hearing that there are hundreds of people in these facilities. And they said, they took them all away. And I said, when? And they said, the day before yesterday.
To where?
And I asked them where, and they said two places. They dumped a lot of them in Juarez. So they took hundreds of people and just dumped them in the streets in Juarez, Mexico. And then they also took them, some of them, to Arizona, to certain CBP facilities in Arizona, which also have been notorious for poor conditions.
Vice President Pence and Nancy Pelosi reportedly have some kind of handshake agreement about conditions within the detention facilities that you visited, the amount of time children could be held there, and that Congress will be notified within 24 hours if a child in detention dies. Do you trust the administration?
Absolutely not.
To honor that agreement?
Absolutely not. I don't trust them at all. I mean,
on anything.
Probably on anything, on most things, but definitely not on immigration. This agreement is being struck at the same time that DHS is ignoring congressional requests for documents. We have been asking for documents about the whereabouts of separated children for months. We've been asking, where are these kids? Where are their parents? What are the conditions in these facilities? How are we accomplished? We've been asking the Department of Homeland Security for troves and troves of documents to help figure out the situation. And they have been completely non-compliant. They won't give us a shred of paper that helps us find these kids.
My experience of you is that you don't say anything just by chance. You think things through when you tweet, unlike some other government officials and other human beings. You use the phrase concentration camp to describe these facilities along the border. And I'm sure you didn't do it mindlessly. You knew you have a sense of history, certainly, where the Second World War is concerned and Auschwitz and all the rest. Why use that phrase, knowing that it would be incendiary even to people, some people, who might be inclined to agree with you?
I think one of the reasons why I found it important to use this term is because this whole crisis and the treatment of migrants at our border has been this low-grade, static, background noise torture that has been happening in our country. And it has been getting worse and worse and worse. And then more accounts started coming out recently, court documents, very disturbing accounts from lawyers, from interviews. And then academics started to say these are concentration camps. There was an academic consensus on this.
You're not comparing Auschwitz to the
detention center. Not. And that, of course, is where the right has gone with it. But no, concentration camps are a dehumanizing tool that have been used from authoritarian regime to authoritarian regime.
In the absence of a sane immigration policy.
That's right.
In the absence of a Democratic majority, what is the answer?
So there's a few. One is we have, I think, as a country, a misunderstanding of the issue of immigration. We think of it as a standalone issue. It's like asking, what are you going to do about homelessness? But these are systemic issues. Once you're at the point where you are mitigating what is happening at the border, you are already dealing with the symptoms of a large amount of other U.S. policies. So, for example, A large contributing factor to the surge on the border is the fact that President Trump withdrew U.S. humanitarian aid to the Northern Triangle countries.
To Central America.
To Central America. The United States, in my opinion, the United States has completely abdicated its responsibility and role in Latin America, in that we are not acting like an equal partner or neighbor in the Western Hemisphere at all.
Yeah, one of the things that you've been saying, I think, for quite a while now, as certainly every bit of a couple of years, is that ICE should be abolished.
Mm-hmm.
The answer to you often is, well, why not reform ICE? Why can't that be done with ICE?
Because the core structure of ICE, I believe, and frankly, the entire Department of Homeland Security, you know, this was established by George Bush right in the wake of 9/11. And people sounded the alarm back then that these agencies are extrajudicial, that they lack effective oversight.
Would you get rid of Homeland Security, too?
I think so. I think we need to undo a lot of the egregious mistakes that the Bush administration did.
In addition to greater foreign aid to Central America,
mm-hmm.
and abolishing ICE, what else would constitute a sane American immigration system? If, in fact, we're not saying we don't really need one, all we do is just let in anybody mm-hmm. who wants to come, which you don't seem to be saying at all,
mm-hmm.
what constitutes a sane immigration
policy? So I think, one, a sane immigration policy, we should not be using detention for people who have harmed no one. One of the big things that I saw when I was at the border was needless bottlenecks, and this is where it really seemed very much so that the cruelty is the point. This is not a lack of resource issue whatsoever. There's a lack of desire to allow refugees, and there were plenty of American citizens that are trying to step up to the plate, American citizens that are saying, we'll take a family in, we'll take children in. They have most of these children that come to the border already have sponsors. They come with phone numbers and they come with people in the country that are willing to take them in and give them refuge. And we have a system that deliberately blocks those families from seeking and taking up Americans who want to give them refuge.
My conversation with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez continues in a moment. We spoke just a few days after her trip to the border to look at migrant detention facilities. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. About a week ago, I sat down with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She spoke about her relationship with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi her tour of migrant detention facilities on the border, and why she chose to use the term concentration camps to describe them. And I asked her as well about the 2020 presidential race. Did you watch the Democratic Party debates the two nights?
I watched the first one, and I watched parts of the second one. I wasn't able to catch the second one.
I'm sure you watched the relevant parts.
Yes.
What did you make of them?
I thought they were good. I think the structure, the very structure of the debates are flawed.
Because they're so gigantic.
Because they're gigantic, they're unfocused, and so as a result, it seems like they are kind of intended to be a clash of personality.
Besides Marianne Williamson, who impressed you the most.
I think the debates offered really good performances from, I think there's a large consensus on this. I think on the first night, Elizabeth Warren and Julian Castro really distinguished themselves. I think the second night, of course, Kamala Harris had a very large moment confronting Joe Biden.
Was she fair?
I think she was fair. I absolutely think she was fair. And I think this is, it's also part of a larger discussion in that issues of race and gender are not extra credit points in being a good Democrat. They are a core part of the competencies that a president needs. We have to understand that our country is one of the biggest experiments in a multiracial democracy in the history of humanity. And if you don't understand the multiracial or the multi-identity part of a multiracial democracy, it can severely hamper your capacity to govern.
You worked for Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think he did? Is he too old?
I don't think it's about being too old.
You can't be too old in this situation?
I think that...
We're looking at two guys. Let's face it. We're looking at two guys who going into the presidency, Biden and Sanders, they'd be older than Ronald Reagan coming out.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to age, I think age gets used as a proxy for capacity. And so I think there are some folks that are of a certain age where you can kind of question their capacity.
Who are you talking about?
I think Donald Trump is one, is a perfect example. I don't think he's all there.
Joe Biden?
I think Joe Biden, his performance on the stage kind of raised some questions with respect to that. But I don't want to say just because someone is 79, they can't or shouldn't run for president. I don't want to use those proxies, a number as a proxy for capacity. I think you have to assess a person's capacity kind of on a case-by-case basis.
What makes Joe Biden not there for you? And if he were to get the nomination, or a centrist of any kind, mm-hmm. center, left, whatever he's, however he's self-defining himself, but certainly a center figure in the Democratic Party, how should progressives behave?
Mm-hmm. And it's not just about being a centrist per se. It's when you are struggling to talk about segregationists and you err on the side of discussing them in glowing terms, that is a big problem. I think struggling and talking about women's rights is a big issue. Struggling to convey respect for women in this day mm-hmm. and age is a big issue. I think those are systemic issues. Like, those are very deep. Those are not gaffes. They are problems. And so it's before you even get to where are you on public college and where are you on a living wage, I think just like, where are you on understanding the people that live in this country?
I guess what his supporters would say, and even you could make this argument, is how do we all, when you take somebody who's had a long career
mm-hmm.
and they were living in times of old standards of mm-hmm. speech, mm-hmm. Political reference, mistakes,
mm-hmm.
When are they disqualified and when is that just part of the package? Because you're 29.
Nine. Mm-hmm.
And let's say we're sitting here or somebody's sitting here with you in 20 years and you're running for president.
it's possible that you'll do everything perfectly for the next 20 years and make no mistakes, but maybe not likely. Mm-hmm. How do we hold people accountable for old standards of the way people addressed each other,
right,
the way they were physically with each other in Joe Biden's case?
So I think
busing itself was certainly an incredibly complicated mm-hmm, issue at the time.
Mm-hmm. So I think number one indicator on this is, does the person know how to apologize?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know how to apologize for praising segregationists, then that's a red flag already. You know, because I think people are very forgiving on that. I think people understand that over the course of a career, as the country evolves, our politics will evolve. But if we approach past mistakes with defensiveness and just say, then that I think is indicative of a problem, because if you're defending a past position that the country has moved on from, then it calls into questions for your judgment for the present.
I totally hear you. But you know one politician who never apologizes for anything and seems to succeed and thrive on that? Donald Trump.
That's right. And that's why—
Never apologize, never explain.
Right. But do we want—
No, but—
Do we want
Look at
that?
The success mm-hmm, of it. Mm-hmm.
And there's success in it, but there's demagoguery in it as well. You know, just because demagogues have come into power doesn't mean we should model ourselves off of them.
You are, in many ways, a social media politician. You communicate well on social media. People follow you into the, how many followers do you have now on Twitter?
On Twitter, like—
7 trillion, I think it is.
4.something million.
A lot bigger than your constituency, let's put it that way. And yet, mm-hmm, it's a tough place to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever shut down from it? Do you ever say, I'm taking 3 days off, I'm not looking at any of this?
Yeah, I do. And also, I have guardrails, like, while I'm using it.
What are they?
So I really try not to look at my mentions a lot. That's like a huge kind of zone. Also, I understand how these platforms work, which helps me and my mental health a lot.
Give me a hint.
So, for example, Twitter does not prioritize what is most popular. They prioritize what is most controversial. So the first thing that you're going to see is probably racist, because that's the most controversial thing that you can lob. So they reward, not just Twitter, but all these platforms, all these algorithms, reward controversy, they reward racism, they reward sexism. And so I already have a set expectation of what I'm going to see. I already know that political parties, the right, dark money groups pay for troll farms, Russia as well. And
do you ever get hurt by what you see or read about yourself on social media?
I get hurt when I read something from a person I respect.
When does that ever happen?
So once in a while, a journalist, like if I read something from a journalist that like true, that I feel just like doesn't understand the full context of the situation, sometimes I'll be hurt or I'll be disappointed if I expected something better. But for me, being hurt is about disappointment. And so you only get hurt if you're expecting things that you don't get. And so like I expect some people to be racist. I expect some people to try to hurt my feelings. So when they do, it doesn't, I don't mind at all. But when I expect something better of someone and they kind of go another way, sometimes it does hurt.
Do you have time to think? I don't say that I say that in the best sense. So much is coming at you. You are the initiator of a lot. You've decided not to be a low profile freshman by any stretch of the imagination. And this just doesn't stop. It's mm-hmm. coming at you, it's coming at
yeah.
you, it's coming at you through whatever means, texting, speeches, appointments, meetings, God knows what else.
Mm-hmm.
How do you organize your thoughts? How do you make priorities of 1, 2, and 3 and mm-hmm. say, you know what, I can't concentrate on 5, 6, 7, and 8?
Yeah. So in terms of that time, this is one of the reasons why I really relish my time in committee so much. And I relish being a lowly freshman on committee too. I'm very fortunate to have built my campaign in a way where I'm not dialing for dollars for hours every day. No, and it's a real—
But why should you be dialing for dollars? You're not going to lose that seat in a year.
I mean, in a year, I feel confident in our reelection, but we have a census and gerrymandering coming up. And when you are critical of people in your own party, it's entirely possible that in 22, I could get a spaghetti noodle of a district.
And you're going to be in Staten Island suddenly.
And yeah, exactly. And so I think about that too. I don't think that I'm here forever. I don't take my seat for granted. But, you know, kind of getting back to the question, when I'm in committee, because I don't have to dial for dollars, I spend hours in committee. And a lot of times it's thinking and learning about a specific issue, but I use it as a jumping point to think about other things, too.
And do you give yourself a break? Is there something that you do for yourself so that you can, what do the kids say? Self-heal?
Yeah, self-care.
Self-care.
I garden. I've discovered gardening. Which has really been really rewarding. I won a little community plot lottery, and I didn't use my name. I used my partner's name, so I didn't get any special treatment, or I don't think I did.
What are you growing?
So I've got dahlias. I've got collard greens. I had spinach, but now it's too hot for the spinach, so I might plant some peppers. I had Swiss chard, which is really good, sage, basil. And it's really healing. It is. It really is to just forget everything and just have your hands in the dirt. It's just really, it's one of the best parts of my day.
Well, thank you. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, member of the House from the 14th District of New York. She and I spoke for over an hour, and you can find more of our conversation on our podcast. Look for the New Yorker Radio Hour on any podcast app. And please stick around now, because in a minute, our music critic sits down with singer and songwriter Carly Rae Jepsen. And we'll hear Jepsen in a live acoustic performance. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
It's hard to look right at your baby, but here's my number, so call me maybe. Hey, I just met you.
Remember 2012? It seems like about 50 years ago. But if you've forgotten your ancient history, 2012 was the year of Call Me Maybe. Carly Rae Jepsen's song was so big, so in your face, that ubiquitous is an understatement. In the years since, Jepsen won a legion of fans and the devotion of countless critics, including several of my colleagues here at The New Yorker. Her fourth record, Dedicated, just came out in May, and while she was still working on it, this was back in 2017, Carly Rae Jepsen sat down at The New Yorker Festival with our music critic, Amanda Petrusich.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. My goodness, I mean, I wish you guys were around every morning. That's just like the best, sweetest response. It means the world to me.
So your last album, Emotion, was released in late 2015. Sorry, I'm just asking for it now. I know, I'm provoking it. I can't help it. So lyrically, a lot of the songs on Emotion, I think, either describe or sort of take place in what I would call a kind of liminal sort of in-between state. So sometimes, as in I Really Like You, it's that kind of tense and extraordinary moment right before a relationship begins. Or in a song like Boy Problems, it's the moment right before a relationship ends. So I wanted to start by talking with you a little bit about what interests you about those kinds of high-stakes moments.
I don't know if I know the answer to that completely, like what attracts you to anything. I think I had a fascination my whole life with love, and I think because of my lifestyle, being on the road, there is sort of more a fantastical side of love that I've experienced, and that is like the high of, you don't get the day-to-day kind of mundane chores, but you get like the runaway weekend in Paris. And it's this sort of feeling of, I don't know, movie style love. And I think I'm quite addicted to that feeling. But it also has its ups and downs and everything in between. And with emotion, I was really looking for a way to tap into kind of the different phases of love that I was allowed to talk about, which were things that I had experienced. Mm.
Yeah. So you have said, I love pop music from the 80s because there's so much longing in it. And I thought, gosh, that's exactly right. And it's a melancholy kind of longing. And it feels to me that something different is kind of happening in contemporary pop nowadays. It's a little more boastful or sort of self-empowering or maybe even self-aggrandizing at moments. And it's kind of less frank about how sad or suffocating desire can be sometimes. I mean, was that also a sort of theme for you as you were working on the record?
I don't know if I thought too much about it. I do remember falling in love with the 80s around the time that we were in Osaka at a festival where Cyndi Lauper was playing, and she was doing like, girls just wanna have fun, and like that kind of dug into some old school Madonna and some Prince, and I think you're right, that sort of feeling of maybe not holding your heart back so much, and just sort of being like, this is passion, and this is real, and this is life and death. I loved that versus just like, we're having a house party. Like, I don't know, I just needed more. And I think that pop can be thought of as trite if there isn't that emotion behind it, if there isn't really, almost like in a 1940s like jazz song, it's like a very constricted amount of space for lyrics, so let's make every word count, and like, let's not talk about trite things, let's talk about the heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Prince, and I hear a lot of Prince on emotion, particularly in the title track, I think something about your phrasing, and also in LA Hallucinations, the way you sort of hit the beat that hard. I mean, is he an influence of yours, and are there other records in your collection that maybe would surprise some of your fans?
Well, I find if I'm working during the day at one type of music, if I'm working on sessions right now for this next album, I'll go home and I'll... I'll go home and I'll need to listen to very opposite. So I'll drive in the car to 40s on 4, or I'll listen to like classical at home and kind of need to just rebel from what I'm doing. And when I was doing Cinderella on Broadway, I would run to Prince in the morning. That was sort of my, like Cinderella had a little, like, you know, kiss. And then that would sort of motivate for the day of just, like, being ready to go into, like, this very romantic, theatrical side of myself. Yeah.
That's awesome, because Prince's sort of the consummate performer in a way.
Yes, and his rhythms are just so exciting, yeah. And that's sort of what caught my attention, I think.
Absolutely. I know that you wrote over 200 songs for Emotion.
Yeah.
Isn't that right? You have been teasing us with some of those B-sides. Do you ever get writer's block?
No, but... But that doesn't mean I don't write bad songs. I mean, if you wanted, I could write you a song right now. But it might not be good, but it would just be, I never run out of ideas, no. And I never stop enjoying doing it. And that's, I think, what keeps me so excited about having found something I love so much is that, I mean, I'm probably about 80 songs deep for this next album. And I keep on sending, like, whenever I get on a flight or anything, I'm like, if something were to happen to me, I've got the order in my closet underneath the back. Please, still release it.
So, Call Me Maybe was released at the end of 2011, of course became one of the best-selling songs of 2012. But I wonder at a certain point, do you have to kind of, and you mentioned this a little bit when you were talking about heading into the recording sessions, both for Emotion and for the new record, do you have to kind of compartmentalize that success in a way, almost mentally or emotionally, sort of place it aside to kind of move forward and make new work?
I think there was a time and a place in my life where I really had to, and that would be in between releasing Kiss, the album, and releasing Emotion, because I knew I was sort of identified as, like, Call Me Maybe Girl. And I can remember even 4 months after its release sort of being claimed in the press as, like, a one-hit wonder. And I was like, isn't it too soon to, like, decide that? Like, give me a chance. And but again, talks with Tavish, talks with my bandmates, they were just sort of really adamant that this was not how they identified me, and nor how I should identify myself. So that was a really important time for me to compartmentalize it. But at this point in time, it just feels like a really wonderful ride and memory, and kind of part of the catalog that was a high for sure. And who gets a dream like that to come true? I'm so lucky. But also, it was like crazy. So, like, so I'm glad it's done. Yeah.
So I don't think anyone here would forgive me if I didn't ask about the new record.
Well, I don't know, because being 80 songs, it could be a lot of different things. At this point, it's about kind of choosing them and polishing and getting it to a place where I feel like order makes sense and everything. I was really highly attracted to this sort of understated disco. But having an intention and going into the studio, sometimes I would realize that, wow, like, I wanted disco, but I made a mamba. So and so I'm not really giving any disclaimers about what this is going to be, because I think it's got different different flavors in there, and I'm really excited about it. I think that I'm finally at that place where I'm starting to feel like, whew, now's the fun part of, like, cleaning and polishing and picking all this stuff. But it's great to have an intention. It's great to sort of say it's got to have, like, a little bit of this understated disco while still tapping into this. And then I can remember trying to explain it in an articulate way to my publishers and my A&R guy, and they were laughing at my pitch so hard, because I was like, okay, so I want to make an album kind of like music to clean your house to. They were like, what? And I'm like, no, but think about it. I don't want to do it at the club because I don't know, and I don't want to do it, like, when else do you listen to music? Like, exercising? Like, I want to clean my house and put on an album that I can just listen to. And feel in a good mood about.
Well, now I have to ask, what do you listen to when you're drying the dishes or, like, unpacking your suitcase?
I'm really into Wolfpack.
Oh,
have you guys heard that song, Backpack? Mm-hmm. Different things. I think that it's really important to push yourself to continue to find new music. And, like, Spotify is great for that. There's a lot of different ways where you can be, I don't know, just sharing, like, get your coolest music friends and, like, send playlists romantically to each other. That's, like, my favorite thing to do. I'd be like, I heard that you're going to China. I made you a China and On playlist for that, you know?
That's amazing. You are a great friend. On behalf of The New Yorker, thank you for coming. And now I think Carly has someone she would like to invite on stage.
This is Tavi Tav, Tavish Crow, my love.
Hey.
So it's strange to make, like, a synth-based pop album and then do them acoustically. We always find that to be sort of funny to me. But we're going to do it anyways. And if you want to sing along, we always encourage that. It'll make it less awkward. We're going to open with How I Feel About This Room Tonight, which is, guys, I adore you. I'm really, 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 really I really wanna stop, but I just got the taste for it. Feel like I could fly with the boy on the moon. So honey, hold my hand, you like making me wait for it. Feel like I could die walking up to the room. Oh yeah, late night watching television. But how'd we get in this position? It's way too soon. I know this isn't love, no, but I need to tell you something. I really, 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 really like you. And I want you, do you want me, do you want me too? I really, 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 really like you.
It's like everything you say is a sweet revelation, and all I wanna do is get into your head. Yeah, we could stay alone, you and me and this temptation. I'm sipping on your lips, hanging on by a thread. Baby, late night watching television, but how'd we get in this position? It's way too soon, I know this isn't love, no, but I need to tell you something. I really, 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 really like you, and I want you. Do you want me? Do you want me too? I really, 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 really like you, and I want you. Do you want me? Do you want me too? Oh, did I say too much? I'm so in my head when we're out of touch. But I really, 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 really like you, and I want you. Do you want me? Do you want me too?
Thank you.
Carly Rae Jepsen performing I Really Like You at the New Yorker Festival in 2017, along with Tavish Crowe on guitar. She spoke with our critic Amanda Petrusich. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining us. Next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, our reporters fan out across the city to cover one of the biggest events in the history of the world, the landing of two men on the moon. Please join us.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Cal Aaliyah, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Mengfei Chen. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.